Richard Newman, you profile the history of Love Canal from when people finally started to find out what was there to the situation today. But Love Canal doesn't seem to go away.
Well, Love Canal doesn't go away because it's a problem that won't go away. Toxic waste is comprised of a lot of chemicals that, as one activist once told me, don't know that they're supposed to go away or they're supposed to stay in one area. It has a shelf life of hundreds of years. It's very caustic. Of course, it's well named as a toxic substance. So it doesn't surprise me that there are problems today as there were back in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s associated with Love Canal.
But people use the term today. It's been 40 years. Do a lot of the people that use the term around the country not really understand there really was a Love Canal?
You know what's interesting about that? When I was writing the book, I was sure that everyone not only knew what the phrase referred to, but understood the deeper meaning of that history, the activists, the location, the fallout. And since the book has been published, I think that I was wrong. A lot of people know that Love Canal was a famous hazardous waste disaster. They know that it was important for the creation of Superfund. But beyond that, I don't think they have a lot of knowledge about that. And so for that reason, I'm really glad that the book is coming out now.
The whole issue of hazardous waste won't go away. I mean, we're getting earthquakes in Oklahoma because somebody's using deep well disposal to dump fracking waste.
Well, that's the other reason I think the book is really important and hopefully timely, is that the Love Canal tragedy was not just one where hazardous waste seeped out of a dump and got into people's homes and the government rushed in and immediately and magically took care of all the problems for the citizens. Love Canal is about citizens at the grassroots level rising up, organizing to take care of a problem that wasn't really on people's radar. And I think in that way it's a model for folks who are trying to deal with fracking waste. Folks are dealing with some of the problems in Oklahoma and Ohio. It's a model for people who might be dealing with lead in water in Flint, Michigan, or in Newark, or in Philadelphia, because it's really about citizen activism and mobilization in the end.
A great deal of the book that you tell the story is about citizen activism. They were, even back then, these housewives don't quite understand what's going on out there. We're the corporate executives. We know.
Right, and that was the first way that folks in the industry and in government tried to neutralize citizen protest, is to say that either this is an isolated cause, or as time went on, you really don't know what you're talking about, you're not a scientific expert. And so it's all the more important that we pay attention to what they did, because these activists, mostly women without college degrees, took on a whole way of thinking about hazardous waste, about politics, about science, and said, you've got to pay attention to us. These are real problems that won't go away. They affect people's health and lives. And if you do take some action, it's going to redound to your credit. And I think they were right. The Superfund program has identified and cleaned up hundreds of toxic waste sites around the country. It's allowed people to see where the worst sites are. And I think most important of all, it's given people a language to talk about hazardous waste. When Lois Gibbs and others first organized about the problems at Love Canal, it wasn't as if they could point to a debris field and say, that's where the tornado flattened all these homes. They had to get people to see inside of their homes. They had to get people to think about what it would be like to exist where toxic fumes emanated, where toxic sludge rolled down walls, and get people to see that that was a really pressing problem, and they did it.
One of the interesting things about that time and now is that it's the political system colliding with the STEM programs. Most of the politicians involved had no idea when you start talking about dioxin or trichloroethylene or PCBs, and they're sitting there saying, what are you talking about?
That's right. And I think this is another part of the story that really is interesting. Behind the Love Canal activist struggle were a series of very sympathetic scientists, folks like Wayne Hadley at the University of Buffalo, Stephen Lester, who eventually became an advisor to the citizens, folks around the country, some of whom I interviewed, talked about the way that Love Canal made them reexamine science, the implications of technology. And then, of course, when it came to congressional testimony, you had senators and congressmen listening to housewives talk about the impact of technology that folks in the industry had just described as very safe, not problematic. And it really, I think, provided a morality play on some of the underside associated with the science century, the chemical century, the nuclear century, all of a sudden people in Congress were confronted with people who were directly impacted by all these advancements and the hazardous waste that flowed from them.
But it's a very American history. We've got all this waste. Let's dump it out back.
And then hopefully it'll go away. And as some people at the time said, the earth is like a big sponge, so it'll just sop up anything that we dump into it. And they were wrong. And it took the citizens and their allies to mobilize in a way that brought this problem back to light. And I think that's ultimately one of the strangest things about writing about Love Canal in the year 2016. Love Canal, in many ways, is invisible again because the dump site is fenced in. There's no signage saying this is Love Canal. For folks who have been out to Niagara Falls and the LaSalle section of Niagara Falls, along the LaSalle section of the Thruway, they might know that you go past a big open field with a fence around it, and if you had no understanding this was Love Canal, you wouldn't realize that you're basically walking around 22,000 tons of hazardous waste.
It's a very American story in the sense that you have people organizing and forming groups and fighting government.
Yeah, Love Canal comes about a decade after some of the most serious organizing in American society, protests against the Vietnam War, organizing for civil rights, organizing for women's rights. Of course, the first Earth Day was in the spring of 1970. So in one sense, they had a lot of models. What they didn't have were a lot of environmentalist models for their type of activism, folks who said, your neighborhood, your house, your playground, your school, that's worthy of an environmental movement. And I think another great legacy of the Love Canal protest movement is that they provided a new model for environmentalism. Your daily living environment was a place that should be protected. The environmental rights that you have there were very, very important, and no one could take them away from you.
And, of course, that has shifted today to people saying, well, we don't want any change because something might go wrong, the NIMBY or the banana situation.
Yeah, as soon as Love Canal protesters organized, they created debate in the 1980s about the perils of NIMBYism, the not in my backyard movement.
It was in their backyard.
It was in their backyard, but now that whole idea, that whole movement has stymied all sorts of progress. And I think the thing that the critics got wrong, first of all, is that there were a lot of backyards that needed to be cleaned up and a lot of people who were worried about things that went into their backyard, rightfully so. But more importantly, there were a lot of people in political and economic power who had the ability to make sure these things didn't get into their backyards. So anytime folks talked about NIMBY, they automatically conjured images of working class people who were complaining about something they had no business talking about. What they were really talking about was political power. Who decided what hazardous waste sites went where? And that's, I think, still an important discussion today.
Well, it was Hooker or Armand Hammer or various other people patting people, male and female, on the head saying, we really know what's going on.
Yeah, and I think the great lesson is they didn't. In New York in the early 1980s, a state senator decided to do a survey in the wake of Love Canal, and they found out that there were over 600 hazardous waste sites spread throughout the state. Virtually every county, all the boroughs in New York, even the most pristine areas up around the Adirondacks had hazardous waste sites. And New Yorkers didn't even know that these existed, and the only reason that they started talking about them was because Love Canal activists had put the issue out in the open. So it's pretty clear that the folks in industry didn't even realize how bad the subject was.
Well, in New York City, they're still fighting about the Gowanus Canal and a couple of other projects and still trying to figure out how to clean those up.
And that's just the sites we know. I was just in New York City, and there are a lot of people who are excited that the cleanup plan is finally going to get started after several years of study. But you always run into activists and people from various parts of the city and the state who say there's probably an even worse site over here or over here. And it's little wonder that New York State is the second largest the second or third largest holder of hazardous waste sites in the country? I'll have to double check that.
But obviously, people say, well, New York isn't the only state with all of these chemical plants.
New York State had a whole series of industrial and atomic and nuclear and chemical plants in the early 20th century, and so it makes sense that they would have a lot of hazardous waste sites. California, New Jersey, New York, even New England, they have a lot of Superfund sites today because of all the industrial buildup that occurred in the early 20th century.
You have to wonder about places like Texas. You go down along the Gulf Coast.
What's the next Love Canal? That's one question people often ask me. I say, think about where your cell phone goes after you deposit it. Think about all the oil and hydrofracking exploration that's gone on in the last couple of years. Just because we haven't seen any sort of major Love Canal in the last few years doesn't mean that there isn't one looming in the distance.
One of the interesting things about people like Lois Gibbs and some of the other people in the community around Love Canal and on Love Canal at that time is they never stopped being activists to today.
That's true. A lot of people thought at the time that the residents of Love Canal were self-interested, that they couldn't sell homes that were in some way contaminated by hazardous waste, and so they were merely trying to get a government buyout, and that's where the problem stopped. But these folks were committed to environmental reform. We're talking about Lois Gibbs, Luella Kenney, before she passed away, Pat Brown. There's a whole series of activists who are less well-known to history who registered the same dedication that Lois Gibbs did, and once they were evacuated from the Love Canal area, they decided that this was too important an issue to give up, and so they remained activists, whether they moved to Florida, Nevada, other parts of New York State. They talked to schools, they talked to university classes, they talked to church groups, they come back every couple of years for anniversaries, and they give tours of their old neighborhood, and they say, we want to make sure that no community has to experience what we experienced in Love Canal.
Late in the book, you talk about the health studies of the people who lived in Love Canal, and there's been a lot of criticism that the studies aren't very good.
Yeah, this was supposed to be one of the most extensive studies of a human-made disaster anywhere in the world, and the state of New York and the Centers for Disease Control and all the officials who contributed to it should be proud that they tried very hard to get as much information as they could, but there were some flaws in the study, such as the fact that it really only focuses on people who lived in Love Canal in the late 70s and early 80s. It doesn't have exhaustive documentation from certain registries which weren't completed, cancer registries and death registries. So you might say that it's an imperfect but important picture of Love Canal health. And the health study discovered that although in general Love Canal people weren't more likely to die than folks elsewhere, there were several different disease patterns that were more likely to occur in Love Canal residents. For example, site-specific cancers like bladder or kidney cancer, also deaths associated with depression, accidents due to some problems with motor function. Many of these things might suggest the presence of chemicals in the body.
I did cover the problems at a industrial plant just down the road with Love Canal, which had a terrible, awful history with bladder cancer of people dying because of the chemicals used. So it may not have been just the canal.
It might not have, but it doesn't mean that Love Canal wasn't a really important event for the study of environmental health or epidemiology. What Love Canal protesters and their scientific allies did was question our basic assumptions about environmental impacts. So whether or not hazardous waste is the only thing that contributes to cancer, it's very likely that it does contribute to cancer in some way, especially when you're talking about the synergistic effects of various chemicals. More importantly, if you think about the way that the Love Canal Medical Fund defines environmentally related illnesses, it's important to know that Love Canal activists redefine the way that you think about impacts. The standard level for deciding whether or not something influenced a cancer or a health malady is 95%. And in the case of the Love Canal Medical Fund, they use something along the lines of 80%. Is it likely that this contaminant was involved in your health malady? If it's likely, then we're going to contribute some funds to your medical care.
When you went back and did the interviews in the book, how many people told you, it's too long, go away?
No one told me that. There were no activists who didn't want to talk about this. There were few politicians who didn't want to revisit it. The only people who didn't really want to talk about it, and I actually understand why, are some of the people who came back to the redeveloped parts of Love Canal, now called Black Creek Village. They don't want to feel like they're living in a fishbowl. I talked to a few residents there who felt like they were actually living in very safe and habitable environments. They were well tested. They were monitored. And they just felt as if they had made their life choice and people should respect it. Of course, the other side of the story is that there are a lot of people who, like Lois Gibbs and others, say, "I told you so," when new rounds of health claims have risen up in recent years. They've been expecting this all along.
Thank you, Richard Newman. He's the author of Love Canal, A Toxic History from Colonial Times to the Present, as we come up on four decades since Love Canal became something talked about around the world. I'm Mike Desmond, WBFO News.